This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
This evening, an interesting yesod altogether. To do with the Meraglim, the spies which Moshe sent into Canaan, and who returned with an unfavorable report and caused all that trouble. The Sedra starts off telling us, Shlach lecho anoshim, send for yourself men, v'yosures eretz Canaan, asher ani noisen livnei Yisrael, ish echod l'mate avosov, tishlocho kol nosi vohem. Send for yourself men who will spy out the land of Israel. Rashi says, Anoshim. What does it mean when it says men? Only where's Rashi gone to? Kulam Anoshim, and then it repeats in Pasuk Gimel, Vayishlach Esom Moshe, and Moshe sent these men, Mimidbar Paron, Alpi Hashem, Kulam Anoshim, they were all men. So Rashi has the difficulty, obviously they were all men. It says Rashi, no, Anoshim, Kol Anoshim Shebimikro, whenever the Torah uses the word Anoshim, Loshun Chashivus, it's a Loshun of importance. These weren't just ordinary men, these were VIPs, these were people of the highest stature and the highest status in Jewish society at the time. They were people of very great people. We know they turned out not to be so great. They turned out to do some very damaging and nasty things. Says Rashi, but at that moment they were kasherim, they were kosher people, they were worthwhile people. What I want to look at with you this evening is, so when did they go wrong? This is a frightening statement. That they were anoshim, they were chashuvim, they were choice people. Not in our generation, in a much greater generation than ours. We wouldn't even qualify to exist in that generation. The greatest of ours aren't as great as the smallest of them. And in that generation, one of the greatest generations that there has ever been of Jewish people, these were handpicked as chashuvim, as men of great importance and men of great stature. They weren't ordinary people. They were among the greatest that we've ever had in Jewish history. When we're looking at leadership, when we're looking at stature among people in Klal Yisrael, these were chashuvim. And they're called chashuvim not by you and I. When you and I call somebody a VIP, it doesn't mean he's a VIP, it just means he drives a black motor car with a fancy number plate. That's all it means. Not being called VIP by you and I. And he's not being called a VIP even by the great people of today. He's called a VIP by Moshe Rabbeinu. They're called VIPs by the Torah. They're called VIPs by the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. God calls them Chashuvim. Can you imagine how great these people were? Oiso shor kasherim oyu, at that moment they were great. What happened to them? When did they fall? And if they fall, what chance do we have who aren't on that level? It's staggering to think of how great a person can be and how low he can fall and how quickly it can happen. What are we talking about? 40 days. From the time they were chosen until the time they returned. 40 days. In 40 days you can become a nobody. It takes a lifetime to become a somebody. No one knows what it is. Anybody who's in the game of education knows what it is on a much smaller scale. You work on a person and you work and you work and you work and slowly, slowly, step by step, and after a few years he begins to make a bit of progress, and you work some more and he works and together you work and a little bit more progress and things are going fine, and all of a sudden something happens and right down at the bottom again. And what happens? He misses out a few shiurim and then he doesn't understand anymore when he comes back, and it's too much of an effort, and then family commitments and this, that and the other, and all of a sudden the slide takes place. And in 40 days you can lose everything that you've gained for years and years. Sometimes it's that, sometimes it's a word of Lashon Hara can do it. Destruction can take place in a moment. Building takes years and years and years. It's a lesson one has to learn from war. It's a lesson one has to learn from Mili de Alma, just from reading the newspaper. How in a couple of days you can have a country that is devastated. And how long did it take to build the country? Hundreds of years. Tens of years. Sometimes thousands of years to really build it. And it can be destroyed in a moment. That's how life is. To build takes a long time. These are Anoshim Ksherim, Anoshim Chashuvim, great men. How long did it take them to become great? Generations of breeding, plus years of effort on their part. Nobody comes great just so. It's hard, hard work. So let's say they were men in their 40s. I don't know how old they were in their 50s. So you're talking about 30, 40 years of hard education, self-discipline, work. And in 40 days, gone, nothing. They're at the bottom of the barrel. When did it happen? What went wrong? And at what particular point did it go wrong? Let us look first at what they're criticized for. They come back and they report on how powerful the country is and how great the people are in the country and how strong the fortifications are. And so they bring back this report which makes conquest seem unlikely, if not impossible. And in fact they express that opinion, that conquest is not possible. But that's not what they're really criticized for. The Midrash says the following. Omru vanehi be'einenu kechagovim. They said, we saw these giants, they're huge people. Vanehi be'einenu kechagovim. And in our eyes, we felt like locusts, we felt like insects in their presence. We felt like nothing. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, vitati aleihem. I forgive it. But it's not the kind of thing to say. But for that, that's not what I'm getting angry about. Not that they said v'hayinu be'einenu kechagovim, that we felt like insects. Not for that. But what? What does he get upset about? Elo v'chein hayinu be'einehem. But the continuation of that sentence, and so we were in their eyes. They also looked at us like insects. Yoidim hayisim ma'asisi eschem le'einehem. Do you know what they thought of you? Who are you to tell the people what they thought of you? Do you know what they thought of you? Who says you weren't like angels in their eyes? You know, you don't have to have big angels. You can have little angels also, little fairy angels running around the place. Doesn't mean because you're small that you're nothing. Maybe they saw these little people running around and they thought you were angels. How do you know that they thought you were locusts? That, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, for that I don't forgive them. That's a little bit difficult on the surface because you remember a Rashi, which is based on a Gemara in Soto, that they did know that they were thought of as locusts, as Rashi, because they heard them saying. They heard these Canaanites commenting to each other, did you see the locusts in the trees? And in fact, the Gemara says, Omar Rav Meshashaya in Soto Daf Lamed Hei, Meraglim Shakri Havu, were the Meraglim liars? Bishlomo, I can understand where they say v'nehi be'einenu kechagovim l'chai, where they say we considered ourselves as locusts. No good, okay, that's what they thought of themselves. Elo v'chein hayinu be'einehem, but to say we were locusts in their eyes, mana havayadi. Where do they know from that they were locusts? Are they liars? Where do they get this information from? Says the Gemara v'lohi, but it's not correct. Ki havu mavri aveli, tuti arzi havu mavri. When they were being Menachem Ovel, because you remember at that particular time a lot of people were dying and there were lots of funerals and things going on, which was a chesed of the Ribbono Shel Olam, it was a kindness of God at that particular time. And Ki Havu Mavri Aveli, when they were comforting the Avelim, they used to do it under the cedar trees, under these tall trees. V'chi chazinu salku yatvu be'iloni. And when they saw this was an ideal opportunity to spy. They could hear what was going on, what kind of conversation took place at such an occasion. So the Jewish spies went and they climbed into the trees and they listened to the conversation. Shami, they heard the Kamrika Khazin and Inshi the Damula Kamsi Bilona. Have you seen these people that look like little insects in the trees? Have you seen? They heard them say that. So what's the Medrash getting so angry about? They're entitled to say and in their eyes we were also like locusts. We see the Gemara says they heard it said. The Mashur explains that Gemara. The Mashur has a different difficulty. What is the Gemara asking there? Were they liars? We know they were liars. How do we know that they were liars? Because the Gemara says, and Rashi brings it as well, that when it says Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvashu, this is a land of milk and honey, right at the beginning, says Rashi, you might remember that whenever you talk Lashon Hara, see that you say something true in the beginning. Because if you say nothing true at all, people won't believe it. So at least start off with something that people will accept. Now you can even learn how to talk good Lashon Hara from the Torah. You can learn everything in the Torah. If you want to talk Lashon Hara, you want to be real effective and real distractive, don't make it all nonsense. Say something which is true. So you see from there that only something was true, says the Ma'asho. You see from there that the only thing that was true was that it was an Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash, there was a land flowing of milk and honey, but the other things they said were untrue. Says the Ma'asho, they didn't see any giants there, because the giants used to live in Hebron. And the only man who went to Hebron was Kalef. It says in the Torah, in the singular, that he went to Hebron. It doesn't say they went, it says he went to Hebron. And the Chazal learned out from there that it was only Kalef. Vaya'alu v'negev, and they went up through the south. Vayovoy at Hebron, and he came to Hebron. And Rashi brings Kalev levadoy halach sham. Only Kalev went to Hebron, and that's where the giants used to be. So when they came back and they said we saw giants, says the Mashal, that was a lie. They didn't see giants. They heard that there were giants in Hebron, but they didn't see. So the question is, what Rav Meshashaya asks in the Gemara is not, were they liars? We know they were liars. What he asks is, but you know, if you want to be a liar, don't tell a lie that you can be caught out on. You must at least tell a lie that you can't be caught out. So to say that we felt like locusts, it's a nice story. You saw giants, they were so big that when we saw them, we felt like locusts. It's a bit difficult to accept such a story, but you can't catch them out on it. That's what they saw. But then when they say, and in their eyes we also were like locusts. Where do you know that from? Answers Rav Meshashaya, they could answer. We were sitting up in the trees and that's what we heard them say. So again, you've got no answer, you've got no claim on them. But it was all a lie. So you see that even though it was a lie, the Rebbeinu Shalom is prepared to forgive them that. To say that you saw giants when you didn't see giants, it's a lie, it's destructive, you're trying to destroy the morale of the people, but I'll forgive you. To say that you felt like locusts, these giants were so big that you felt like locusts, it's an exaggeration, it's a lie, you didn't feel like locusts, but good. You imagine that if you would have seen the locusts, the giants about which they speak, probably you would have felt like a locust. Good, I'll forgive you that too, says God. Maybe that's the function of a spy, to project his view even beyond what he sees. Maybe. But to say that you were a locust in their eyes, who says? Who says that you were a locust in their eyes? That loy vitality, for that I don't forgive you. Seems quite a small thing on which God is catching them out. And on that he won't forgive them at all. What's wrong with that? What is so terribly serious about that? That for that they don't go to Eretz Yisrael. And for that they dray around in the desert for 40 years. And that whole generation doesn't go into Eretz Yisrael. For saying, and we were like locusts in their eyes. What's the terrible thing? The lying God isn't makpid about. He forgives them. All the other things he forgives them. That point, says the Medrash, he doesn't forgive them. What's the big terrible thing? To answer that, I'm going to use a yesod which I developed in the later shiur this morning. And it's in fact a continuation of that part of the later shiur that I repeated to you last week. You remember last week we talked about the establishment of Shaul as king, and that Shmuel gave the people Musaf when he got old. He called the people together and he gave them Musaf. He decided to rebuke them. And he rebuked them on the basis that they asked for a king at the wrong time. It wasn't Derech Eretz. There's nothing inherently wrong in asking for a king. On the contrary, the Torah makes provision for a king. But that wasn't the time. Shmuel was only 50 years old. He was an active leader. It's true he had become old, but he said, I've become old because of the way I was serving you. It's true that my children aren't going in my ways, but my children aren't going in my ways because I didn't have the time to educate them because I was busy with you. And when I've sacrificed everything for you, it's not for you to turn around and appoint a king because you're dissatisfied with my leadership or with the fact that my children aren't going in my ways. That you should have waited. Well, you don't. It's a good thing, but it's at the wrong time. And to demonstrate that fact, you'll remember he prayed for rain in the springtime when they were busy harvesting the field. And people realized at that moment that there are many things which are good in themselves. And not only are they good, but they can be done with good intent. And not only can they be done in good intent, but they can be done in a nice manner. But if they're done at the wrong time, it's no good. Take it. It doesn't work. Not only must you do what is right, and must you do it in a fine and in a good way, with the right intention, but in addition to that, you must also do it at the right time. And a good thing in the wrong time is a curse. It's an absolute klala. It's as bad as a bad thing. Rain in the springtime is a curse. Rain in the winter is a bracha. It's a blessing. Is rain good or is rain bad? Depends when. Depends on the timing. And we talked about the fact that you can't learn in the Torah that easily. To learn when to do something, you can't learn in the Torah. To learn what's good and what's bad, you can. But to learn that fine sense of timing, that you can only learn from emulating a Rebbe who has that sense of timing. You can't just, that's something you have to pick up intuitively. It's not something you can pick up intellectually. We're then told in the next chapter that Shaul experiences his first crisis as king. Yonatan, his son, assassinates a Philistine governor. And that, of course, as you know, you assassinate a governor, can start off a world war, never mind a localized war. And the Philistim got angry and they started getting ready for war with the Jews. The people gather around Shaul, and Shaul starts dilly-dallying. He waits and he's waiting and he's waiting. Why is he waiting? Because when he was anointed, Shmuel gave him a brief rundown on some of the key points of his kingdom, of his rulership. And Shmuel said to him, you will go to Gilad and you will wait for me there 7 days until I come, and then I will bring sacrifices and so on. So he was in Gilad and he realized this is the time Shmuel was talking about, and he has to wait 7 days. So he waits the first days and he sees the Philistines. The first day he sees the Philistines mobilizing. Not only does he see it, but the Jews see it too. And at that time the Jewish people had no arms whatever. Nothing. The Jews saw the Philistines mobilizing. Most of them ran away. Immediately they fled. They emigrated. Country's in trouble. They emigrate. The riots in Soweto. Off we go. He waited another day. Now not only have they mobilized, but they're driving towards the border. All their tanks and all their weaponry. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers. Horsemen, chariot men. All coming towards the border. And here these Jewish people are with nothing. So of those that were left over, another whole lot emigrated at that point. He waits a third day. Now they're already massed on the border and they're starting to aim their tanks and their cannons and everything, ready to run in. Some more run away. And those that don't run away hide all over the place. He waits a fourth day. Each day he waits, he's losing more and more of his army, and the Philistines are getting stronger and stronger. He waits the sixth day. Comes the seventh day, he waits. The seventh day, no Shmuel, he brings a sacrifice. Why does he bring a sacrifice? He explains to Shmuel later, I see the Philistines are about to attack. You said wait 7 days, so I've waited 7 days. As difficult as it was and as hard as it was to exercise the patience required to wait those 7 days while my army was disappearing and the Philistines were getting stronger, I waited the 7 days. But now I realize that any minute they're going to attack, and I haven't davened yet. I haven't appealed to the Ribbono Shel Olam for help yet. And in those days they used to daven together with a sacrifice. So as to not to be caught unawares, I immediately on the seventh day brought the sacrifices so that I could be mispalel to the Ribbono Shel Olam, that we should be saved. So what Shaul did was good. He prayed and he brought sacrifices. Nothing wrong with that. He waited 7 days. He didn't do it too early. He did it for the right reasons and for the right intent. He can't be faulted on anything. Beautiful. What he did was right. The greatness of Shaul to watch his army disintegrate and wait, because that's what he was instructed to do. And Shmuel says, you idiot. Your kingdom is lost. For that you've sacrificed the right to be king. and it was God's original intention to keep you king forever, you and your children and so on. Now no longer. God is going to look for another king. What's the terrible thing that Shmuel did? That Shaul did? Say the Mefoshim, he was half an hour too early. He didn't wait long enough. He waited 7 days, he waited till the seventh day. They didn't wait for Shmuel to come. Shmuel was on his way already. He was just a few hours or half an hour, whatever it was, too early. That's what he did wrong. He acted too early. The action was right. The intention was right. The manner was right. Everything was right. Except the timing. He was too early. And that's serious. And that signifies the collapse of Shaul's kingdom. And I explained to the ladies the connection between the collapse of Shaul's kingdom and the appointment of Shaul as a king. Shaul was appointed as a king. Nothing wrong with it, except the timing. And what was wrong with the timing? It didn't show deference to Shmuel. Why does Shaul fall? The timing. What he did an action which was good, but the time was wrong. What was wrong about the time? You didn't show deference to Shmuel. You should have waited for Shmuel and you didn't. So exactly on the fault on which he was, or the very fault that existed in his appointment, is the very fault which causes his downfall. It's unbelievable. And from there I developed a yesod which I put to them, and that is the following. When a thing is founded on an ethical fault, when the thing in its foundation has an ethical fault, it cannot last. And it will collapse because of that very fault ultimately. It might last a year, it might last 5 years, it might last 10 years, who knows how long. But ultimately it will collapse. It won't have eternity, it won't last forever. I told them about yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael that were once founded on ethically wrong principles. And they flourished for 12 years and collapsed immediately after 12 years. Totally non-existent. A whole string of yeshivas. You can't have long-term survival in Torah with something which at its foundations has an ethical fault. A halachic fault, you can fix. You can do tshuva, you can fix a halachic fault. The thing wasn't done altogether l'shem shamayim, that's also serious. You didn't do it altogether for the right intentions, that's also serious. But when a thing has an ethical fault at its basis, it cannot last at all. It's doomed to failure. It's just the tragedy of life. It has to be that way. It cannot last. And its fall will result from that very flaw with which it was built. Shaul's kingdom was built with an ethical flaw. The flaw was lack of deference to Shmuel. It was a wrong timing. The timing did not take into account the feelings of a man to whom they owed so much. No halachic flaw. There's no halacha which says you may not have a king. There's no halacha which says at that time you may not have a king. The halacha says whenever they demand a king, you may have a king, and that's why they were given one as soon as they demanded it. They didn't transgress a din. They didn't transgress a halacha. They transgressed ethics. They transgressed Musa. They did it without sensitivity to a man to whom they showed owed HaKoros HaTov. And for that, that kingdom was doomed to failure. And it only lasted 2 years. Not that the whole kingdom only lasted 2 years, but 2 years after the anointment of Shaul, David was already anointed. And that was the decline of Shaul's kingdom. Of course, the question is, why did Shaul suffer, the ladies asked this morning? If the people were incorrect in their demands for the king, and they were insensitive to Shmuel, where did Shaul go wrong? That we'll answer later on. And if we're going to accept that principle, let's use it to try and find out here what went wrong. Because it would appear that's the only kind of thing that could have gone wrong. And you're starting off with Anoshim Chashuvim, you're starting off with such great men. The only thing that could have gone wrong is that somehow the basis of the mission was wrong. That in some way they were sent off incorrectly. That they were charged with a mission which was not right. That there was something ethically wrong in sending those spies. There was something wrong in Musa in sending those spies. Let's examine. Is there anything wrong halachically in sending the spies? According to the halacha, if one would open the Shulchan Aruch and one would look at the dinim and say, is there anything wrong? Nothing wrong at all. It's the logical thing to do. You're going to conquer a country. The thing to do is to spy the country out before. Do you think that the Israelis didn't spy every inch of Lebanon out before they went into the place? They knew every tree and every boulder, everything. They knew absolutely exactly where it was. They've been spying it for years in preparation for that day. It's the logical thing to do. And even though this was going to be a miraculous war, and they were going to win it by miracle, not by conventional warfare, nevertheless, the din is, Ein somchin al hanes. You don't rely on miracles. You've got to do as much as you can do. You do the rest, you leave to a miracle, but you don't sit back and do nothing. So they want to take whatever natural steps one would take under such circumstances. After all, when they went into the country, they did fight. They actually fought a physical war with spears and with arrows or whatever it was that they fought with in those days. Why didn't they just sit and say, miracles, we'll do miracles, but you've got to, the action of fighting, you've got to go through, you've got to act it all out. God will help you win, but you've got to act it out. Surely spying is the first step that one takes in military warfare. What's wrong with sending spies? And in fact, their motivations were much more holy than just pure spying out. There are three views which are given in the Medrash HaGodol in Dvorim. The first view is the view of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says they wanted to spy out the land because they claimed that in the desert they were being shown the way by this pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. However, they knew that when they entered Eretz Israel, that would no longer exist. So they felt they needed to substitute that with a map. They would need to know where the streets go, where to go. They're not used to finding their own way around. They needed time to study the way the land was laid out. That's very logical. The second view is the view of Rabbi Nehemiah, and he says even greater. Says Rabbi Nehemiah, they were afraid of a chilul Hashem. God had promised them all these treasures and wonders. He says, what's going to happen? As soon as the people of Canaan realize that they're about to be conquered, they're going to take all their treasures and hide them away. That's also a natural thing to do in warfare. And we, the Jewish people, will come there and we'll find that it's all gone. Where's all this promise of treasures? So let spies go in now and find out where their vaults are, where they're going to hide these things, so that they know where to look for them. So that there won't be a chilul Hashem, that when we come, we'll find all the treasures which God promised us. What foresight! What a beautiful idea. There's nothing wrong with it at all. And the Chachomim say even greater than that, the third view in the Medrash HaGodol. Say the Chachomim, they came on a halachic basis. And they said the din is that anything which has been worshipped, any object which has been worshipped as idolatry, needs to be destroyed. However, if the worshipper himself undid it, for example, there's an idol which they worshipped, and the worshipper himself smashes the idol, then the pieces of the idol you can use. The one who worshipped and did it is mevatel la'avodah zorah, you don't have to destroy it. So they claimed when they would come into the land, they wouldn't know what needs to be destroyed and what doesn't need to destroy it. Every building, every tree would have a shiloh on it. Maybe this was used for idolatry. Let people go in and spy out the land and see what is used for idolatry and what isn't, what they have been mevatel and what they haven't, what they do serve and what they don't. So we won't have to destroy the whole country needlessly. Again, what foresight, what lamdonis. That's genius. There's nothing wrong in their request. So not only if they would have consulted the Shulchan Aruch, not only would they have found nothing wrong with their desire to spy out the land, but they would have found that it's fully in that the Shulchan Aruch would be in full agreement of their going out to spy the land. Just shows how wrong one can be even if one acts according to the Shulchan Aruch. One needs that fifth volume of the Shulchan Aruch, which has never been published and never will be published. It's that fifth volume of knowing how to be a mensch as well. Knowing, as we've said in the last few shiurim, that there are certain things we don't do. Where does it say we don't do it? It doesn't say we don't do it. The day Torah will have to say that these are things we don't do, oy vavoy for Torah. It shouldn't be necessary to say such things. That you learn from your father. That you learn from your rabbeim. That's just not how we behave. And unless one has to understand that there's just so much of Judaism that you won't find published and that you won't find printed, that's something you have to have instilled into you and injected into you until it's part of you, that you just know that we don't do. And you can consult the Shulchan Aruch and find it's good, it's right, and yet it's wrong, we don't do that kind of thing. What was wrong about them going out to spy the land? So I could really find only one thing. In Dvorim, in the first chapter of Dvorim, Moshe says, "Vatikrevun elai kulchem, you all came before me. Vatoimru, and you said, Nishlecho anoshim lefonenu, let us send men before us. Veyachburu lonu es haoretz, and let them search out the land. Vayoshivo esonu dovar, and they will give us information. Es haderech asher naale bo, what route we should take into the country. Ve'es haorim asher novo aleim, and which cities we should conquer first, how we should approach the conquest. Vayitav be'einai hadover, and the matter made good sense to me," says Moshe Rabbeinu. He accepted it. Vo'ekach mikem shnei mosor anoshim ish echod lashovet, and I took 12 people, one from each tribe. Says Rashi, "Vayitav be'einai hadover." Rashi says again, quoting a Gemara in Soto, "Be'einai veloy be'einai amokum." It was good in my eyes, but not in the eyes of God. God didn't approve. I approved, but not God. What's wrong? Why? That Moshe approved, we understand. We've just checked. There's nothing halachically wrong with it. Why didn't God approve? Rashi says the following on Vatikrevun Eli Kulchem, and you all came before me. What does Kulchem mean? You all, why didn't you say Vatikrevun Eli, and you came before me? It says Rashi Be'ir Buvia, that a whole mass of you came. You came en masse. Ulahalan Huemer, and further on in chapter 5, he says, Vatikrevun Eli kol roshei shivtechim v'ziknechim v'tovru hein heronu. At Matan Torah, at the giving of the Torah, what does it say? It says, you all came before me, the heads of your tribes and your elders, and you said to me, etc. Oiso kreva oiso hygienis. That coming to me, that approach to me that you made then, it was hygienis. It was refined. It had midas to it. It was ethically correct. Yelodim mechavdim es hazakenim. The young people showed honor to the older people. V'sholchum lifneihem, and they allowed the older people to go first. V'zakenim mechavdim es haroshi, and the older people were mechabed the leaders, and they allowed the leaders to go first. That's why it says, kol roshei shivtechem v'ziknechem, you all came before me, the heads of your tribes and your elders. It specifies them, it breaks them down into those classes. Says Rashi, because that's the way you did it. You sent your roshim first, and then Yozakenim, and then came the young people. Aval kan, but here, Vatikrevun Eli Kulchem Barbuvia. You all came charging towards me. Yelodim Dochvim es Hazakenim. The young people were pushing the older ones aside. It was the Kenim Dochvim es Haroshim, and the older people were pushing aside the leaders. It was Bedlam. What do we see? We see something ethically incorrect. They wanted spies? Good. Nothing wrong with spies. It was Neshem Shemayim, it was for the right intentions? Good, lovely, beautiful. They wanted to spy out the land to know what road to take? Good. Or as Rabbi Yehuda says, they wanted to spy out because there wasn't going to be a pillar of fire? Good. Even better, says Rabbi Nehemiah, they spied because they wanted to make sure that they would know where the treasure is hidden, that there wouldn't be a Chilul Hashem? Even better. Or the Chachamim say they wanted to know what has been worshipped as idolatry and what hasn't? Fantastic, wonderful. Everything's beautiful. But the way you did it was not right. There was something ethically wrong. There was no Musa. You came to me, the young people pushing the older people pushing the leaders, everybody being trampled on, everybody trampling on. That wasn't right. And that's why Moshe tells them about it in his final speech to them. The way you approached me, Vatikrevun Eli Kulchem. Because the Mefoshim ask, why does Moshe Rabbeinu mention this in his Teichocho, in his Musa? He says in the next sentence, I accepted the idea. If you accepted them, why are you telling them off? And the Mefoshim answer, he was not telling them off in that they wanted spies. They're entitled to have spies. He's telling them off in the way they did it. It wasn't like at Har Sinai, where deference was shown to the wiser people and to the older people. What is the ethical concept that lies behind showing kavod to older people and to chachamim? We've talked about that in recent shiurim, about the whole concept of kibud av ve'em and of kavod rav and talmidei chachamim, and we laid down some foundations. But this is a little bit different. V'hodarta pnei zoken. It doesn't say mipnei seva tokim v'hodarta pnei zoken. When it talks about showing honor to older people, it doesn't use the word kavod. It uses a different word. Hodata, show glory and honor in the English sense rather than covet to older people and to wise people. What is the ethical principle that lies behind that din, that halacha? There's a tremendous lesson to be learnt in the way we relate to our old people. If one relates to them with deference, one is expressing a concept that brute strength is not what's important. As a man gets older, he gets weaker, doesn't get stronger. Yet we have to show him more and more honor. It's exactly the opposite of the world, what the world is used to doing. We show increasing honor as a man gets weaker and weaker. Why? Because he's getting stronger and stronger, really. With the experience he's accumulating, with the maturity that he's accumulating, with the lessons of life that he has learnt, with the insight that he has, he's getting stronger and stronger, not weaker and weaker. If you have an appreciation for that kind of strength. And that's the ethical lesson that lies behind honoring an old person. Honoring an old person shows that what we respect is courage of strength of character, not strength of muscles. What we respect is a moral sense that we respect. Experience, wisdom. That's what we show covet for, not for brutes. Not interested in brutes. It's a whole reorientation process that needs to take place. If I say to you, what is your a strong man? Who would you name as a strong man? Strongest man you can think of. The answer should be Rav Shach. Something like that. Whoever it is that you want to name. Not Mahmoud Ali. He's not the strongest man. But we don't grow up like that. We don't think that way. We like to think that we think that way, but we really don't. If you were stopped in the street and asked quickly to give you immediate response, who do you think is the strongest man in the world? You wouldn't even think in terms of Gedolim or old people. You'd think of some young man with muscles that really, who was the last Mr. Universe? That's what you would try and think and try and remember. That's not the way a Ben Torah thinks of strength. That's not what strength is to a Ben Torah. And training oneself to show increasing respect to people as they get older and weaker physically, but stronger and greater morally, training oneself to do that is training oneself to reorientate one's attitude towards strength and towards who one shows respect to. When these people came, everyone pushing everybody else, the young people pushing the older ones pushing the leaders, what was being shown? Survival of the fittest. The world in which we live, I don't know whether Darwin discovered survival of the fittest or invented survival of the fittest. But be that as it may, since his time, the world has only operated by survival of the fittest. The stronger and more ruthless you are, the more successful you are inclined to be in the short term anyway. That's the way they were then. Ruthless in their desire to get their point across. Trampling over people, pushing people aside. Who was likely to get to the front? The strongest. The youngest, the most athletic. Moshe didn't have a chance to listen to the views of the older people and the leaders and the mature people. They were trampled on, they were lying behind on stretchers somewhere. It was the young rabble, the coarse grob and so-and-sos who managed to get to the front. That was the ethical wrongness, the ethical wrongdoing in their asking for the spies. Nothing wrong with a question, with a request, nothing wrong. But with the atmosphere in which that request was made showed that there was something wrong. What was wrong? Respect for brute strength rather than respect for spiritual and moral strength. What was their downfall? Their downfall was exactly in that. They got terrified by the brute strength of the Canaanites. How strong they are. Giants we saw there. Oh, you know what it is, giants, huh? The only way you got to the front of the row was because you pushed. And you realized that those people you can't push around. Canaan, there you won't be able to push anybody around. They'll do the pushing. Now what? Now we can't capture them. We're useless. Our whole strength is in our physical strength. That's how we got to where we are. What are we going to do with people who physically are so much more powerful and so much stronger than us? There we see that principle that we developed in the late issue. That the very source of the moral decadence which lies at the foundation of the action is the very thing which brings about its downfall ultimately. What about Kalev? We mentioned that Kalev went to Hebron. Why did he go to Hebron? Says Rashi, Kalev levade holach sham. Kalev alone went to Hebron. Venishtateach al kivrei ovos, and he davened and bowed down at the tombstones of his ancestors. So that he should not be attracted to his friends to be a part of their scheme. Why did he have to go to Hebron to do that? Why didn't he go to Yerushalayim davened by the Kosel? Why did he go to Hebron? It's true there wasn't a Kosel yet, but that doesn't matter. There was the place where the Kosel was going to be. Why didn't he go to Yerushalayim? That was the holiest spot. He goes to Hebron, to his ancestors. Risks his life in the land of the giants. Exactly that. He realizes the only way to be saved from this tendency is to understand that it's my ancestors who had it all right. That old man Avram, that old man Yitzchak, that old man Yaakov, they're dead already. But that's where my koach lies, in them, not in me. In what they discovered, in what they started, in what they set up. In their refinement, in their midas, zechus avos. That's why we start our Shmona Esra every day, three times a day. Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. I'm not praying to my God. I don't have any right to pray to my God. What did I deserve? What did I do to deserve an audience with my God? Have I tried getting an audience with somebody in Rome there, Lavdil? Not so easy. Never mind three times a day. And God, I've just got the right. Knock on the door and there I am, here to talk to you, Ribbono Shelolam. As if you've got anything else to do. And he must listen. And if he doesn't answer my prayers, I get angry the next day. I davened and he didn't answer. What right have I got to impose so much on the Ribbono Shelolam? I don't have any right. Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Except I have Yichus. Ribbono Shel Olam, remember my Zayda, Avraham, and his son Yitzchak, and Yaakov. I'm an einikel of his, I'm a grandchild of his. Please let me in. No? What can you do then? That's protectsia. And we daven with protectsia, that's the only way we can get in there. We don't have the right to daven without that. And Kolev realized that. On our own, we have no possibility of being victorious. We've done nothing to merit this land. It was promised to them. It was promised to the old people. It was promised to the previous generations. And only through their schus will we conquer this land. It won't be our own power. No, once you understand that, then you don't get frightened of giants. Giants! What do you think Kolev thought when he thought of his grandfather Avraham? In what kind of terms did you think he thought of him? A giant. A huge man. That's how he pictured him. Yitzchak, a giant of a man. Yaakov, oh, what a man. Can't be scared of these little giants. It's nothing. We're not going to fight them with normal brute power. We're going to fight them with hundreds of years of civilization. With hundreds of years of Torah and of commitment to Torah and Kedusha and Tahara. And with a Ribbono Shel Olam behind us. That's what we're going to fight them with. So Kalev, looking at the same scene, sees it differently. It's not that the ones were lying and the others weren't. They saw it differently. The other spies were unable to see the land in the light that it had to be seen. Lastly comes the question. But, okay. The spies. They themselves weren't the ones who demanded to send spies. It was the rabble. It was the mass. They were the ones who were sent. Why did they fall? The same questions we had with Shaul. Shaul wasn't the one who made the mistake, who timed it wrong. He didn't ask for a king. He was busy looking after the donkeys. It was the other people who asked for a king. Why did he fall? Exactly parallel we've got. They ask for it, and the leaders fall. And also let's come back to the question with which we started. When did it happen? At what point did they fall? There's an amazing Rashi, again based on that same Gemara in Sotah. It says, Vayelchu vayavoyo Moshe v'Aaron, and they went and they came. Asks Rashi, what does it mean they went and they came? They went, and then they were there for 40 days, and they came back. You don't just mention it in one breath. They went and they came. It says, Rashi, Mahu vayelchu. Why does it tell us here again that they went? Lahakish halichoson lebioso. To tie together their going into Canaan with their coming out of Canaan. Ma bioson be'etzorah, in the same way as their coming out from Canaan was with bad intent, Afhalichosun be'itzara, so their going was with bad intent. Now we're running into difficulty. At what moment did they fall? When they went, already they fell. This wasn't something that took 40 days. We started off saying, amazing how in 40 days a great man can fall right down to the bottom. It wasn't 40 days, it was a moment. Because as soon as they set off, they had already fallen. What caused that fall? Let's just try and understand that. That's rather important to know. What it is that caused such great men, chashuvim, people who the Ribbono Shel Olam calls chashuvim, what caused them so quickly in a matter of minutes to become people who mistake greatness for bigness? What is it? There's a wonderful Orach Chaim HaKadosh on this. He says the following, Efsha, Letzad shekavonos hameshalchim hoysoro, taf'il poel hara b'shaliach. Because the intention of those who sent them was bad, that affects the shlichim, the agents, badly. V'yachzer liya shluchoi shel odom kemoise. And says the Orach Chaim, that famous halachic concept of shluchoi shel odom kemoise, that a man's agent is like himself, applies philosophically too. And they took on the colors of those who sent them. That's what the Orach Chaim HaKadosh says. An amazing idea. What does it mean? It means that no matter how great you are, and how outstanding you are, and how independent you think you are, the fact is, when you're working for someone, you take the attitudes that he takes. When you're bound to somebody, when you're under somebody's influence, shluchei shel odom kemoise, you become like him. You take on his value system. What a frightening concept. Anoshim chashuvim, people that God himself called important. When they lost their independence, they lost their integrity. Unbelievable. How difficult it is to retain your integrity under a situation of pressure. When you stand to lose a job, to be able to remain honest. To be able to remain honest to your system of values. We're not talking about people who don't know what honesty is. That we've been talking about in the last shiurim. How to decide what is morally right or wrong. These people knew they were chashuvim. If they didn't know, who does know? They knew what was right and what was wrong. They saw what happened to Miriam, that you don't talk Lashon Hara. They knew that they had to encourage the people, not discourage them. But they took on the atmosphere and the whole tone of the people who sent them. V'shluchoi shel odom kemoiso, says the Orach Chaim. A man's employee becomes like himself. A man's workman, and the man who is under your control becomes like you. What a frightening concept. Now we understand with Shaul as well. It's a contagious disease. And it's particularly contagious for leadership. A leader stands to catch the diseases of his followers so quickly. The moment he loses his independence, the moment he's not prepared to take the risk of losing a job, the moment that happens, and he'll rationalize it in all sorts of ways, I've got to, because if I don't take it, somebody worse than me will come in. There are all sorts of ways of rationalizing it, be that as it may. The moment a man feels that by losing the support of the power behind me, I'm impotent, at that point you lose your integrity. To believe that your power comes from behind you, that your power is from your employer, from he who sent you. The moment you become merely a shaliach, you become kamoisa, you become like the people who sent you. The only way out of that, there's no way out of that. Shluchei shel odom kamoisa is a principle, it's emes, it's true, there's no way out of it. The only, so to say, way out of it is to make sure that you're a shaliach of God, not of any human being. Because the moment you're a shaliach of a human being, you've lost your independence of thought. You've lost your integrity, you've lost your moral courage. Because you believe you're acting on his behalf. Only when you see yourself and feel yourself as acting on God's behalf and on his behalf only, can you do that which you believe is right, without taking into consideration other shikulim, other things to weigh and to consider. recently a certain Rav told me that he was having an argument with the president of his shul. And the president of the shul turned around to him and said, Rabbi, I am your president. And he said, Mr. President, you are wrong. You are the president of the shul. You're not my president. My president's up there. Because I didn't vote you in. I'm not a member of the shul. I'm not a member of your committee. You're not my president. That's how a Rav has to be able to think when he's employed by a community. Not my bosses. I don't work for you. I work for God. And it's not only a Rav who has to think like that. Every individual and every human being has to think like that. I don't work for my boss. I work for the Ribbono Shel Olam. And if I'm honest, I'm honest because God said I've got to be honest. And if I'm loyal, I'm loyal because God said I must be loyal. And if I come to work on time and I don't leave work early, that's because the Ribbono Shel Olam said that it's against the din to come late or to leave early. And if I don't waste time at work and I give of my best to my employer, it's not because I'm working for him and I'm scared of him. It's because that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam says a Jewish workman has to do. And if I give my full attention to make sure that the job is the very best I can possibly do, it's not because I'm scared of losing the job, it's because that is the din, I have to do that. That's what it is. It's a whole different orientation. I'm working for God, not for you. It says the Orach Chaim elsewhere, that perhaps is the meaning of Shlach Lecho Anoshim, send for yourself men. And we're told they were Anoshim, and I mentioned to you also the Balaturim, that Shlach Lecho Anoshim, the last letters, Ches, Kaf, Mem, is Chochem, Shlach, Lecho, Anoshim. And on Friday night I asked, why, what's the Shlach, Lecho, Anoshim going to do with it? Says the Orach Chaim, it's Lecho, Anoshim. These people are great only as long as they are your messengers. Shlach, Lecho, Anoshim. If they see themselves as acting on your behalf, Moshe, they'll be Anoshim. But they're not great enough to overcome the temptation to be loyal to your employer, to those who sent you, over and above everything else. That they're not great enough for that. No one is great enough for that. That shluchei shel odom kemoisa. As great as they are, they're being sent by people who respect brute strength more than chokhmah, who respect strength more than experience, who respect youth more than old age. Those people are sending them, they're going to go with that value in mind. And that's why the Medrash says, Sofu yoyo lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It was known to God that they were definitely going to come out wrong. That they were going to talk Lashon Hora about the land. There's no way that people who are sent by such people, as great as they are themselves, they lost their independence the moment they went. Maki shalichosun lebiyosun. The moment they went, they lost their independence. The moment they turned their back on Moshe and they were no longer lecho anoshim, they were no longer sent by him, but sent by the nation. At that point they lost their independence. And they started seeing the world the way their employers see the world. And that is what is strong is right. That's how they began to see it. And there was no question but that they were going to be led into seeing it incorrectly. And that when they saw the might of the Canaanites, they would tremble into a belief that this country could never be conquered. How amazing those two Yesodos are. The first Yesod, that when a thing starts off with a musardika problem, it can't last. It has to fall. And the fall will be generated by that very problem. That's what's going to cause the crack ultimately. And the fact that one loses one's independence. The moment you see yourself as a shaliach, you see yourself as acting on behalf of your shaliach, of he who sent you. And unless you see your shaliach as the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, you're working for a human being, and that is idolatry. That's Avodah Zorah. You don't work for any human being. You work for the Ribbono Shel Olam only. And only if you're working for the Ribbono Shel Olam can you have the independence of mind to do that which is right despite everything else. And only if one is doing that which is right despite everything else can one set up projects which are going to last and which are going to live. And in fact outlive their initiators. Because they'll be set up altaras HaKodesh. They'll be set up with purity and with holiness and with correctness. One can do something which is halachically correct. One can believe that one is 100% correct. But unless it is also ethically correct, you don't even have a chance to succeed. It's out of the question. It cannot succeed. And the knowledge of what is ethically correct and what is not ethically correct, you're not going to find in the books. That's something you have to be taught at home. And unfortunately, we're dealing with a generation who was not always taught this at home. In many homes, Baruch Hashem, even non-religious homes, they have been taught it. But in many homes, no. The parents of this generation were too busy making sure that their children had that which they didn't have. And forgot to give their children that which they did have. And in the process, we have a generation who has all the money that our parents didn't have and none of the breeding that our parents did have. And that's the tragedy of our generation. And not having learnt it from our parents, all we can learn it is from a relationship with Torah which exceeds an intellectual relationship. A relationship with B'nai Torah, with Talmidei Chachomim, with Gedolei Yisrael, each one according to what he's able to do in the city in which he lives and when he travels. To relate, to see how Gedolei Yisrael and how Talmidei Chachomim react. To question them and to ask them why they react in certain ways at certain times. And to try and understand and watch and slowly integrate and imbibe over the years a correct sense of what one may do and what one may not do. So that in Yirtzeh Hashem, everything we try to do and everything we set off will start at its foundations on ethically correct principles.